Welcome to the Student Loan Planner Podcast. I've got a special treat for you today. I have our senior consultant, Rob Burtman, CFP, CFA, joining me to answer reader questions today, or listener questions rather, and also just to talk about some weird stuff about student loan interest and how everybody thinks it's way worse than it actually is when it's really not nearly as bad as you think it is. So Rob, thanks for joining us on the show today.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I feel like I have to defend my age because every podcast you put out, it seems like you make a little jab at that I'm 40.
So Rob did just turn 40 and I just turned 30. So Rob is the resident grandfather of Student Loan Planner at the ripe old age of 40.
That is very true.
Whenever we think about kind of hiring somebody, they've got to be younger than Rob or else Rob gets displaced in the age stack ranking.
Right. This is definitely not an ageist organization.
No, definitely not. I think it's just, the boomers, you know, they just don't understand the struggle, right? They don't understand the student loan. You know, my student loans, I had 1% interest and I easily paid back my $5,000 of student loans working at Jiffy Lube on Fridays. You know, why can't the kids do it now? It's like, oh man, I don't know. Maybe because vet school costs $300,000 instead of $3,000, Mr. 1960s.
Exactly.
And the Gen Xers, I mean, they didn't get it off easy, but they still didn't get smacked as nearly as bad as the millennials, right?
Oh, for sure. No question there.
But I'm glad that we have a variety of age experience, right? So we do have a wide multi-decade stretch of the youngest consultants and writers to the oldest. So I will defend our age distribution on the team, at least for that. So the first thing I wanted to do just to kick it off for this week is we have actually four listener questions on our voicemail, which is a good amount. So if you, listener, wanted to submit your own question, just go to studentloanplanner.com/voicemail. It's really super easy. You just type that into your browser, and then it's going to take you to this just really simple screen that you just press the record button on your phone, and then just speak your question into the phone, or just, you know, like you're maybe having a telephone call with somebody, like you're leaving a voicemail, like literally it's that easy. And then ask your question because it's really fun. It gives us a lot of fun stuff to talk about. So the link for that again, studentloanplanner.com/voicemail. So the first question we have is from Douglas, who wants to know if he can delay his tax filing this year. Let's listen.
Hi, Travis. This is Douglas calling from New York City. It's the tax season, so I thought I'd ask a question that would be really helpful for me, and I imagine many others, about taxes and student loans. Specifically, I was wondering if you could tell me what you thought about a strategy that you mentioned several months ago on the blog, which is basically I want to take advantage of my lower income from a previous tax filing. So you'd mentioned that with taxes, you're allowed to defer or to delay tax filing up until October. As many of us know, the income certification is required to be submitted, I think, as early as August. So therefore, if you had a previously low income in, say, 2018, you could, by this measure, continue to pay on that low income. So to get your payment with IBR down even lower, you could continue to do that for an additional year if you were to delay tax filing until October. So I think you had mentioned that there was some controversy on that method or on that loophole that you'd encountered in speaking with some of your colleagues. But specifically, I wanted to, controversy meaning whether or not it was legal or, you know, some kind of fraud. But I was specifically wanting to know if you thought that it was risky at all, if there was any risk that it would pose for someone who's planning to do public service loan forgiveness. Would there be any risk at the end of the 10 years, especially if you're starting off those 10 years, to pursue a strategy like this that would save you a lot in, or let's say a considerable amount in that payment for just 1 year? Very curious to hear your thoughts, Travis. Thanks so much for all that you do.
This is not the first time we've heard this question. Basically, Douglas is saying you can file an extension, right? And you can extend when you file your income taxes up to, I think it's October, right, of a given calendar year. So in other words, if I'm in the year 2020 and I want to extend when I file my taxes, I can file an extension. And then instead of filing in April with a regular tax date deadline, I can extend that up until the point where it's like, you know, October.
Yeah, it's like October 15th. Yep.
Right. So like, Rob, kind of walk our listeners through why somebody would be interested in this in the first place.
Well, first of all, a lot of people file extensions if they have like really, really complicated tax situations, or maybe they have a tax form that someone hasn't gotten to them yet. So they literally cannot make the deadline of April 15th. And so what they do is actually the tax preparer has to prepare their taxes. And if they owe any taxes, that they actually have to pay those estimated taxes, even though they're not actually going to file until October. So they have to like file for an extension. If they're going to owe any money, they still have to pay that money, but then they can delay the actual filing of their tax return until October. So where this could be interesting for people with student loans is that if you use your tax return as proof of income, which most people should do as long as their income keeps going up every year, that they could actually, let's just say their recertification date is in June, like Douglas said, and rather than using their prior year tax return, they actually get to use 2 years ago tax return. So if it's a resident who became an attending physician, they can actually delay paying based upon their attending physician salary for like an extra year, which could really, really save a bunch of money on student loans. So the question for you, Travis, is that a good idea?
So I don't think it flies. Here's why. So I think that the servicers are starting to get a little wise to these sort of tactics. So we've seen an increase in the number of letters that have been mailed out recently that have basically said people have literally submitted their tax returns and they've given lower incomes or something kind of unusual, right? And then the servicer sends out a letter saying, we want additional information, like we want additional proof of income, which never used to happen before. But some servicers are asking for this. And so we've told people in a lot of cases, just respond again with your tax return. Try not to give them the pay stubs unless they literally force you to give pay stubs. So I think that this is an example of something where we're all for people optimizing, but we don't want people to over-optimize, right? So I think that this is something that I would consider to be over-optimizing, where it could be something that could kind of get you flagged or get more attention drawn to your account, and we would not recommend it. That would be my thought.
Totally agree.
Next, we have a question from Giancarlo, who's a CFP from Puerto Rico.
Hi, Travis. First of all, I want to congratulate you on your podcast. I find it super helpful. The reason I'm reaching out to you is I am CFP from Puerto Rico, and I was recently reached out by one of PR's med school to go talk to their students on their student loans. And as you well know, there's a lot of misinformation on this topic out there. I'm going to be having the opportunity to have them for 45 minutes to an hour. I want to make sure that I cover the most important information with them. I'm going to be talking to a fourth year students in a couple of days. And I was hoping that maybe you could shed some light, maybe some recommendations or some talking points that you might find more useful or more important that I should be discussing with this students. Let me know if you can help me in any way. Anything will be very much appreciated. Thank you.
Okay, this is an interesting one, Rob. First of all, I'm flattered that we have people listening to the show in Puerto Rico. I got a thanks from a reader recently because we listed one of the Puerto Rico universities as being on our cheapest list for one particular program. I think sometimes people forget about Puerto Rico because it doesn't have official statehood, right? You know, so in terms of some of the Puerto Rico universities, I actually see them being a lot cheaper than a lot of the American schools for people that are residents of Puerto Rico. So my guess would be that you would probably come out with a lot less student loan debt for med school in Puerto Rico, which would just be my first instinct. But the same rules for PSLF for physicians apply to every U.S. state and territory, right? So I guess let's pretend for a moment that we've got a Puerto Rico med school grad with $150,000 of student loan debt. Rob, what would you tell somebody like that to do?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, obviously, residency is a great time to be on income-driven repayment, because even though they might have the long-term capacity to pay off their student loans, on a resident salary, it's not as easy with six-figure student debt. So probably want to talk about how to handle student debt and residency, whether it's doing something like repay for the interest subsidy, and then possibly refinancing when they become an attending, or maybe going for PSL, unless they're PSLF eligible. Obviously, that's like one of the things we want to make sure that they preserve in case they want to go that path. So definitely residency repayment would be a big thing I'd hit on. I'm sure you have some other thoughts too.
Yeah. So first of all, like when you graduate medical school, like immediately consolidate your student loans, right? There's really no downside, and make sure that you include absolutely everything that you possibly can in that consolidation. So, you know, any health professions loans, any Perkins loans, basically anything you can think of, try to consolidate it and put it all together, because you probably don't have credit already towards forgiveness. So first do that. And, you know, your payment for the first year is going to be $0 a month. if you use your prior year tax return showing no earnings, right? So I would say for that, for the person who wants to make as much money as possible eventually and pay off all their loans, you know, sign up for that revised pay as you earn program, right? So that's why I would be telling anybody who's a physician who thinks they're going to pay off everything, do the repay plan, because you're going to get interest subsidies at least for the first couple of years, probably the entire time you're in residency. And it's probably going to be a better interest rate than if you had refinanced. And it gives you flexibility just in case you don't need to pay it off at some point. So that would be the advice I'd give. And then also, you know, if you're sure you have your heart set on working at a not-for-profit or an academic place, then I tend to suggest people to do pay-as-you-earn, because then you can stay on that same repayment plan without having to change plans. If you get married, you can file taxes separately, jointly. You know, there's no complications there, and your payment can be capped. And my guess is, coming out of like a lower cost Puerto Rico institution, you know, you probably would hit that standard 10-year cap more easily. Rob, I have to admit, I've seen some weird stuff incomes for medical professionals in Puerto Rico. I don't know if you've ever heard of this, but like, I had somebody once that was doing teleradiology, and he had moved his whole family to Puerto Rico, and he was making like 400 something grand a year. And I think he wasn't even paying like income tax, maybe. Maybe I'm making this up, but I feel like there's some sort of loophole with Puerto Rico where you don't have to pay income tax on a lot of your income or something. I don't know.
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, there's this teleradiology thing where, you know, you don't have to be physically in the hospital to review the charts and everything. You could actually just be anywhere. So it's one of the easier specialties to do that telemedicine idea. But I don't know about the tax implications of Puerto Rico being a U.S. territory versus a state. I'm not sure about that.
Probably the residents of Puerto Rico, I would just guess, are underserved in terms of like the number of physicians per population, right? Mm-hmm. So if anything, like the PSLF program should probably be rewarding people and paying off their loans that just stay in like lower served places like Puerto Rico or rural America or something like that, regardless of what your, you know, not-for-profit status is. Do you know what I mean?
For sure.
I mean, at the end of the day, like, I'm thinking about a place like UPMC, right? Like Pittsburgh's Medical Center. Like, I read that they recently got hit with a lawsuit because the town's basically saying this is like a for-profit hospital that's just like happens to be called a not-for-profit, right? And you could certainly say that I think overall, like, there's tons of doctors in that area. It's not an underserved place. So, you know, your family doctor in Puerto Rico that's maybe making, I would guess, a lower income than the U.S. mainland. So maybe say like $100,000 a year. That person's not getting subsidized, but we're subsidizing brain surgeons in Boston. So I think that's why the PSLF program is going to change, just because it probably doesn't make financial sense to set it up the way that it has. Like, you probably want either just mass forgiveness in general and have higher income taxes to pay for it, or you'd want more of a targeted plan that like makes more rational sense for what the biggest kind of underserved areas are in society. I don't know. I mean, that's probably a whole nother podcast, but it's certainly a really interesting question. So the next one comes from Joe, who has a question about what to do when he graduates.
Hey guys, love the show. My question is something that I haven't really been able to find anything about online. I think it'll probably be applicable to most of your audience, at least the ones that are graduating shortly. And it's going to be about beginning an income-based repayment plan after graduation, and I guess possibly finding a loophole. I'll be graduating this May, then taking a month or two off, starting a job making about $100,000 a year in the middle of 2020. The way I understand it, if I do nothing, I'll have about a 6-month grace period and then have to apply for an income-based plan started in 2021 using my 2020 adjusted gross income of $50,000, which is just the half year of my salary. So I guess my question is it wise and is it possible to apply for an income-based plan as soon as I graduate and then start making monthly payments based on a AGI of nearly nothing while I was in school? Is it possible to even do this? And is it wise? If it is possible, is this something that I would have to consolidate right after I graduate in order to do? And would I need a tax return on file for 2019 to prove that my adjusted gross income for 2019 was nearly nothing? Thanks, guys. Love the show.
So this seems like to me as like a group, do I do the grace period or do I consolidate? And what are the benefits of that? Rob, maybe you can talk to that for a little bit.
Yeah. In general, right after graduating, income is never going to be lower, hopefully, than it ever will be, you know, 20 years from now or 25 years from now. So when we talk about starting student loan payments as quickly as possible after graduating, it's usually a good idea to do that, because 20 years from now, you're going to be in, hopefully, in like your peak earning stage of your life. And so your payments are going to be higher. So any months of payments or any years of payments that you can get early on is going to save you dollars, because if you don't pay at a lower payment now after graduating, then you're going to be paying that higher payment at the end. So yeah, consolidating and waiving the grace period, similar to what we just talked about with resident physicians, is a great idea. Consolidate all the loans, waive the grace period. You can choose your repayment plan, get going on a zero payment if you're between graduation and your job. That way your first year is zero payments. That could save a bunch of money paying back student loans.
To describe it more specifically, he said he'd have a 50K AGI in 2020, but what we usually would see, and then he's going to have 100K AGI a year after. So what we would usually see somebody who doesn't get any kind of advice or do any reading or doesn't listen to a podcast like this, what they'll do is they'll just do nothing, right? Because that's the default, is if you have to do something, most people are probably going to do nothing. So let's say that he does nothing. Okay, so he waits until like December, January to actually start his income-driven repayment. And what's going to happen is his servicer is going to ask for proof of income. Well, he doesn't have his tax return for 2020 yet. He has it for 2019. Maybe he didn't have that at all because he didn't file a tax return, right? Then he's going to submit his pay stubs. Well, if he submits his pay stubs, that payment is going to be $800 a month, $700 or $800 a month. And instead, if he consolidates immediately after he graduates and he has a 2019 tax return that shows a $0 income on it, which is totally legal, by the way, that you submit that tax return as proof of income, and then basically you have a $0 monthly payment, and then you can consolidate and get payments started basically 2 months after graduation, whereas if you wait for the grace period, it's 6 months after graduation. So you get 4 months of free forgiveness payments because it's $0 a month, right? So you get those 4 months of extra credit, you could call it. And that extra credit, those 4 months are coming off of the end, like you said, right? Like the 20 to 25 years, your payment and income is going to be way higher. So that 4 months of credit comes up at the end, whether that's 10 years from now with PSLF or 20 something years from now with IDR forgiveness. So that's going to cost you probably thousands of dollars per month. So that's four times that, 4 months of saving that amount. And then on top of that, you also get your $0 a month payment instead of making a mistake, submitting a pay stub and then getting an $800 a month payment. And that mistake would last from, like, I guess, December 2020 to December 2021. Versus your payment's probably going to be zero, and then you're going to have your 2020 tax return submitted, which would show a 50K income. So then that payment would be like $300, right? So that just simple example would be probably a cost of, I would guess, around probably about $10,000. And that's not even taking into account interest subsidies if he happened to need to pay the loan off. You know, like repay, he could have gotten half of his interest covered instead of less of it covered with a higher payment, you know? So that's pretty staggering, right? It's like basically this guy could literally lose $10,000 in the first year just by submitting his paperwork and using the wrong strategy for his loans right off the bat. That's pretty intense to me.
Yeah, no question. And plus, just starting out, there's a lot of expenses. You know, if someone's moving or someone's, you know, trying to get their job or get their savings started, it's much better to have $0 payments for the first 12 months than to have $800 payments starting 6 months from now, then, like you said, the savings tacked on the end. So it would really help someone in his situation get situated, get moved, you know, start the job and not feel like they have the financial pressure to make $800 or $500 student loan payments right off the bat. So all around, a really, really solid strategy.
And so just for those listening, right, again, this is why you consolidate immediately after you graduate. You go to studentaid.gov. You click consolidate my loans, you throw everything into it that you possibly can. You know, you send it to Great Lakes if you're not doing PSLF, or you send it to FedLoan if you are doing PSLF. And then you select the right repayment plan and you make sure you use, you know, a tax return that's from the prior year that shows lower income, right? You do all this right. That's the blueprint you follow. And if you do that, you could literally save four or five figures really easily in the first year. Or alternatively, you know, that's one reason why people hire us, right? I mean, if you kind of think about it, like, you know, you pay a few $100 to make sure something is done right, or you kind of gamble that it's done right. And if you're kind of uncertain, then you probably just hire somebody. So studentloanplanner.com/help. Basically, you know, Rob, we tend to get kind of booked up around like May, June timeframe because everybody's graduating. It gets super busy. So this is, you know, we're in March when this episode airs. So, you know, I mean, it's not a bad idea if you're graduating, you know, you want to get this done right, probably book for within a week after you graduate and sort of anticipate that. I think you can book like 60 days in advance. So try to probably get that reserved if you want your choice of times. because it's really easy to mess this up and it's really easy to get it right and save a lot of money if you know what you're doing.
It's a $10,000 decision. It's worth it.
Well, it's more than that because the long-term strategy, I would argue, is even more important than that.
Oh, no question.
Yeah, because I mean, you can look at the projected savings by profession and a lot of them are in the mid five figures. And that's just because, you know, somebody doesn't know that they live in a community property state, right? Like you've got a Wisconsin person that's Packers fan that doesn't know that Wisconsin's the only state in the Midwest that has community property laws, you know, and then that has implications for paying less on your student loans, right? And then so I'm trying to come up with a good name for this repay pay filing separate loophole, but it's like the fighting spouses loophole is the name I like. I don't know if you have a better one. If both spouses are pursuing PSLF, that's a loophole that you would almost certainly miss if you didn't, you know, have a lot of expertise in this. Isn't it funny how like the more you do this, Rob, like the more complicated it seems like it becomes?
Oh, man. Yeah. And big shout out to Megan, too, one of our newer consultants. I mean, she's really hitting the ground running and coming up and helping us develop some of these more advanced student loan strategies, putting our heads together. And it's just wonderful to have her on the team.
Yeah. And everybody contributes in their own way. Like, you know, Ben is super helpful as a CPA, one of our other new consultants. You know, but the problem is he's so busy with tax season right now. It's kind of funny, right? Because like anybody who has that CPA combo, it's like, hey, I'm going to be super available after April 15th, whatever, like whatever. But yeah, I mean, like, it's just so helpful to have a team approach because people probably don't know this. But, you know, we have consultant meetings probably every couple weeks or something like that, just to talk through all the complex cases we've seen, all the new changes to servicer information, like complaints that we're seeing with people that, you know, weird stuff that they're getting in the mail. We just do that to try to be, you know, at the cutting edge, basically, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's just something that we try to make sure that we're really on top of. So we got one more question. This is about CBO report that recently came out. So let's listen to this one now.
Hi, Travis. I'm sure you saw the CBO report that came out this past week that showed over the next 10 years, there'll be $200 billion in federal student loan forgiveness, and 81% of that forgiveness will go to graduate and professional students. And I was curious your thoughts on that. And if you noticed the fact that the report did not analyze taxable forgiveness at the end of the 20 to 25 years pay or repay. So thoughts on that? And yes, that is my baby in the background.
The CBO report is really interesting. This is something that was put out at the request of two Republican senators, Senator Alexander on the Higher Education Committee in the Senate. I think it's called the HELP Committee, Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions. So he's the person that would be in charge of writing the student loan reform for the Senate, at least right now. But he's retiring, and he really, really, really wanted to have a legacy of rewriting the student loan rules for the next 10 years before he retired in 2020. That's not going to happen now, probably because nobody wants to compromise until the election is over, right? So he kind of got this parting shot in for this request for CBO report. And I forget the other guy who did it. I think he's like the Wyoming senator. I want to say Enzi off the top of my head for some reason, but basically he also requested this bill. I forget his position in the Senate as to like how it was really specific to student loans, but he really wanted to see this too. You know, if you think about Wyoming, right, it's a place that has a very low proportion of six-figure borrowers, people that probably don't like the idea of lavishing a lot of money on higher education, like that's mostly spent on coastal high urban concentration areas, right? So I think that's like the background of like why this report was commissioned. But the CBO is a nonpartisan organization, and it's staffed with a bunch of really smart economists that do try to do their best guess and their best job of forecasting, you know, what the cost of federal programs will be. But oftentimes it can be super wrong too. The report, I read it actually, it's like fairly long, but it's really interesting to look at the different scenarios that, you know, they modeled for Congress. So they actually said that they expect about 81% of all student loan forgiveness to go to graduate and professional students over the next 10 years, which is really pretty interesting, Rob. And I think this kind of aligns with like what we know and what we think. So they're basically saying about $160 billion of forgiveness is going to go to people with graduate and professional degrees, and about $40 billion or so is going to go to people with undergrad degrees. And that makes sense because undergrad degrees have capped limits. You cannot borrow more than $30,000 to $50,000, period. And most people, 10% of a 50K income over 20 years is going to pay that off in full. So you're not going to get a whole lot forgiven. Meanwhile, you have all these graduate degrees where you can take out an unlimited amount of money for grad school. And that's going to result in a lot of people that owe way more than their income, and they're going to have a lot that's going to be forgiven because of that. And same thing with PSLF, where, you know, if you have a 30 to 50K balance, 10% of a 50K income or something like that is going to pay off a lot of it before you even get anything forgiven. Whereas with a graduate degree, you have a lot more potentially that could be forgiven. So it doesn't really make me that shocked about the ratio. So first off, let me just see what your thoughts are on that split of forgiveness. Like, do you foresee that 80% of forgiveness going to graduate students being a realistic number?
Yeah, well, first, I just want to give a shout out to our caller who is reading the CBO report while managing a young child, which is pretty awesome. I have three kids of my own, so I know how hard it is to read through financial stuff while having a baby on my lap or trying to feed them or whatever. So kudos to you. But no, I'm not at all shocked. In fact, I'm shocked the numbers, the percentage isn't higher for the reasons that you said. I mean, there are a lot of graduate level professions. There are only maybe a few exceptions, like maybe dentists or, you know, specialty physicians that really might have the capacity to pay off their debt. So, right, for example, so anyone who has basically more than twice their income in student loans, income-driven repayment is going to be like a really, really great option for them. And most of those people are graduate-level professions. And a lot of graduate programs, they provide a higher income potentially, but a lot of them don't provide enough of a higher income to compensate for the multiples of student debt that they've had to take out. And typically, in order to get the forgiveness, right, you have to be in an income-driven repayment plan. And so a lot of graduate level professionals who they can't go on the graduated or extended or standard plans or anything like that because they couldn't afford the payments. So they're forced to go on income driven repayment, where maybe someone with like the undergrad and capped borrowing and a lower debt to income ratio, you know, they can afford those payments. So they just end up paying off the loans in full anyway, whether they're on those plans or if they're on income driven repayment. So I'm surprised the number's not higher. The percentage isn't higher, to be honest.
Another thing that kind of bothered me with this report is apparently there's this, like, you know, this law that requires them to estimate the value of all the forgiveness using, like, basically, I think the treasury bond or something like that. Hmm. So in other words, you have to discount all of these cash flows with like a super low risk rate, you know, that you're looking at. And so what they came up with was the subsidy, you know, for student loans over like 10 years or something like that was only going to be, you know, like $11 billion or something like super, super low. Right. And that was including basically them theorizing that they would make a bunch of money on the fixed payment plan options. So in other words, they kind of assumed that a lot of people would pay back their loans over 10 years and they would make a bunch of interest income on it because they're comparing it to what the treasury bond is. So they're like, oh, we're going to make all this money. And then the kind of really interesting thing is like, you cannot discount a student loan at the rate of a treasury bond, because a student loan is an unsecured debt made to an individual with probably an average credit score of like 600. I mean, this is a very risky
loan,
you know, loan. And so they made a point of that in the CBO report. And they said that, well, what is the subsidy? Well, it depends on what your belief is as to what people would have to pay to borrow in the private market. Like, basically they said, so the subsidy is something between $11 billion and $263 billion. Oh, man. And they said the subsidy is $263 billion if you use what people would need to borrow at in the market, you know, reasonable estimate. And they assumed that they would earn $72 billion of interest income from the fixed payment plans. But then when they used like a normal rate of interest, like for the market to measure the subsidies, then they lost $51 billion of interest. So this is really kind of like when you read these reports and you really read the details, it's kind of like a joke, really. I mean, yeah. And the people who are doing the modeling are doing a good job. But this is why the system is so complicated and so screwed up, is because you've got all these requirements that they measure the costs according to some stupid formula that makes no sense in the real world. And then, you know, you look at the costs, you know, using a market kind of interest rate, what the real subsidy is, and that's, you know, a lot more expensive. So just to give you an example, a lot of people I know think that the student loan interest rate is too high on student loans, and maybe it is. But if you charge 1.5% on student loans, then the subsidy that America provides to student loan borrowers is essentially the difference between what a private lender would issue the debt at and what the government is charging. So let's say that you're issuing debt at 1.5% and the market would make that loan at, say, 7.5%. So then you're giving a subsidy to borrowers of that spread. So 6% difference on the total amount of student loans issued per year. To say there's $100 billion of student loans issued per year. And, you know, that includes student loan borrowers, but the taxpayer is providing a subsidy of $6 billion per year in that case in the form of interest subsidies. So, you know, I mean, it's really kind of nuts. One thing that I did kind of think was sort of interesting, they assumed that the pay-as-you-earn plan would result in the largest amount of subsidies. So that kind of aligns with our advice. I was excited to see that because they know that, you know, you can pay for a shorter period of time and that counts. One thing that was not in the CBO report was talking about the benefits of filing your taxes separately. We know that that's a huge source of savings for people that caused them to pay way, way less than they would otherwise pay. And that was not really being modeled all that well. I thought that was kind of interesting.
It just goes to show that there's no way to figure this out because we have some of the smartest people in the room, economic forecasters. But you know, even when we're doing individual student loan consults, I mean, you think about where someone is, let's just say they're 10 years into their career. Chances are 10 years ago, they didn't know what they'd be earning or that they'd be where they are today. That changes things drastically when talking about calculating income-driven repayment and forgiveness and subsidies. And just the fact that, I mean, the most compelling stat you said is that the subsidies either are $11 billion or what did you say, $296 billion? So
yeah, it's a big difference.
It's either X or like 30X, you know?
Yeah.
It's kind of a ridiculous assumption. I don't know.
So here was the most ridiculous assumption of all. This was the most ridiculous, like the thing that just made me fall out of my chair that I was like, this is one of the dumbest things I've ever seen in my life. So they assumed that for plus loans, so grad plus loans made to graduate school level borrowers. So people in, you know, dentistry, medicine, law school, things like that. So they assumed that the government would earn a 40% margin on all of the fixed payment plan loan amounts that were lent under the grad plus program, which has got to be the stupidest, worst thing, assumption in student loans to ever model in history. Because they're assuming that all these graduate school folks are going to pay back their plus loan at 7% for the full length of the term. And guess what? That's not happening. That ain't happening.
You're going to refinance. Yeah.
You're going to refinance it, you know, because grad school people are smart. And you're either going to go for forgiveness or you're going to refinance it and cut your 7% down to 3.5% or 4%. You're going to pay it back with a private lender that gives you a better deal.
Right.
And yet their model that they forecasted the subsidies under, and this they put this into the model for their estimate of, you know, whatever, the $11 billion or $260 billion of subsidies that they're going to give borrowers. They put this into their model, even under that $260 billion subsidy number, that you're going to get billions of interest income from all these graduate school people that are too stupid to apply to refinance their loans, which is just not going to happen. So, I mean, I really think that if you look through this, the subsidies are even higher than they're modeling, really. Like the true market value subsidies is probably instead of $260 billion, you know, it's probably in the neighborhood of probably like $400 billion on $1 trillion of issued loans. So, I mean, it is enormously high. And yes, most of this is going to go to graduate school borrowers, but yeah, that's just because you don't look at the fact that, you know, undergrad borrowers had their loans capped. And so the people that where you see the carnage stories for undergrads is parents who take out unlimited borrowing, because the parents take out the unlimited borrowing because they don't have any caps. And so the parents are the ones that get screwed over for people that borrow too much for undergrad. But it's just, it was really interesting study. And the thing that he mentioned also, the last point, is just that they did not talk about the tax bomb anywhere in this forecast at all. And so they said that if you measure all of the tax income that the government would get back when people had their student loans forgiven, they said that would significantly reduce the subsidies that we're modeling. So I thought that was interesting that they basically just said, like, even Congress's own budget forecaster is, yeah, like, we're not so sure that you're actually going to get all this tax income from this. They even know that you're not going to get all these people with $5,000 in a checking account to pay back a lot of tax and student loans, right? Most graduate student professionals, unfortunately, have all their money in their businesses, if they're, you know, practice owners, their house, and their retirement. And that's pretty much it. That's your typical graduate professional. You do not have $100,000 sitting around in cash that you're going to be able to pay the IRS with. It just doesn't exist for your average person. So I think that was the most interesting part of the CBO study for me. The fact that they just threw their hands up, basically. They're like, you know what? Tax bomb. Yeah. You know, we don't know how to model it. You know, holy cow.
I mean, the good news is, you know, we're getting into the weeds a little bit here in terms of like the technical, but as it applies to those of you, you know, if you're listening and you have student debt, here's the good news. The good news is that they're modeling that there's going to be some sort of forgiveness there for you. They're modeling that this income-driven repayment is going to be working. That's a good sign, because if you hear some of the talking heads out there, they're saying everyone's still kind of latching onto this headline about only 1% of people who applied for PSLF got, you know, loan forgiveness, so the program doesn't work, which is not true. And this shows that it's going to happen.
So one more little anecdotal story. I mean, this is kind of like I hope it's not too scatterbrained of a podcast for people, but this is a really interesting one. So I had this person from a vet school just eviscerate me on the blog the other day. So I want to talk more about student loan interest. And student loan interest is bad, but it's not as bad as you think it is. And if you look at that, this person on her blog basically attacked me because I told one of this prospective student for their school that I thought a back of the napkin estimate of how much debt they were going to leave with was about $350,000, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then I said $200,000 if you're in state. And so this person posted a comment. They were so angry. I mean, so angry. This is like a recruitment director for this vet school. And they were just saying, like, you have no experience in the real world. How about you talk to somebody that actually works at these schools? I just had a talk with somebody from our class of 2019 who's already planning on paying off her full student loan balance of $100,000 by 2029. And so I was like, okay. So I went on their website and literally, I can't make this stuff up. They list on their website total cost for residents of the state, and it was like $50,000 per year for 4 years, so it was $200,000. Mm-hmm. And then total cost for non-residents was like $85,000 or so.
Wow.
So if you summed up that number, it literally, I just guessed, by the way, like my $350,000 projected debt was a guess, and it literally summed up to $352,000. And I was like, bam, your own freaking website says this. I'd like to be charitable, but like I posted that link and the person was like, people get assistance, like they get financial assistance to pay for all their expenses. And that's just not representative at all of what people actually have. And I felt like responding, like I didn't want to be a jerk, but like I felt like responding. So are you just like a freaking idiot or something? Are you literally not capable of doing basic arithmetic, or does your school pay you a bonus every time you sign somebody up and lie to them about how much debt they're going to have? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's what I wanted to say. I didn't say it exactly that way, because I truly believe that, you know, a lot of people are just ignorant. I think it's just, you know, one of those things where like they mean well, they're not bad people, but they're just literally clueless. I think that's like the majority of the people that tell, you know, all these students and prospective students things about their debt and what it's going to be. And, you know, just don't really understand like the details because they just haven't looked into it deeply. I don't know if you have any thoughts about that.
No, in my advanced age of 40, I usually I've learned to not look at what people say, but the meaning behind what they say. And yes, this person is probably clueless, but they're also probably clouded. They probably love their school and they see, you know, the students coming in and that they're very excited to become veterinarians and that this is going to cause people not to pursue their passion because of this. And so it's probably just a prideful person who loves their school, which there's nothing wrong with that, but tact is everything and facts are everything, right? So the bottom line is you are right. And he just doesn't have the number. She's just like so excited about his school probably. But we do need to answer this because I get this a lot too. I mean, the difference between accrued interest and how student loan interest works versus most other kinds of debt is really, really incredibly fascinating. And it makes a huge difference on the projections for loan repayment.
So what's interesting is the interest actually is really bad in the early part of your loan. And then it's really, really, really not bad at all in the later stages of your loan. You know, just like, and as an example of this, like, so this person that I said was going to leave with $350,000 in student loan debt, they're actually going to leave with about $450,000. And the reason for that is because, yes, you have like 6 or 7% interest loans that are accumulating interest while you're in school, right? You've got, you know, if you're borrowing like $80,000 a year, you're going to have whatever, like, you know, $6,000 a year of interest. And then for the first year that you borrow, you're going to have 4 years worth of that. And then you also have your loan fees, which are, you know, 4% for a plus loan approximately. So that's an additional couple thousand dollars every year. And then, you know, the school is going to raise costs too, that you're going to have to borrow for, you know, when they raise the tuition and everything. And so you tack on all that accrued interest, and then the $350,000 like stated amount that the cost of attendance sheet says is actually going to be higher by about 25% more than what that figure was, right?
Right.
You're going to leave with $450,000 of debt because that's about 25% more than what the stated cost of attendance is. But so now let's assume that, you know, you have that $450,000 of debt. So for the first couple years, the difference between simple and compound interest is really not all that great. I mean, walk me through that a little bit, why simple versus compound interest really does look the same mostly for the first 5 years.
Right. So just, I guess, talking through the mechanics of it. So what compound interest is that every year that a loan grows or like an investment grows, the interest in the growth of what happened every year, that then also gets growth too. So let's just say someone has $100,000 at 7% and they don't make any payments. And after a year, the loan grows to 107. Well, then that 107 in a compound interest situation, that whole 107 gets charged an extra 7% interest. So it's not another $7,000. It's another $7,000 and change on top of that. And so what happens with compound interest is over time, you know, that exponential growth curve where it kind of like goes off into infinity straight up eventually, that's what happens with compound interest. But with accrued interest and simple interest, the way that I like to describe it is you take the interest rate. So let's just say that their interest rate is 7% on $450,000 of debt. So you'll take that 7%, charge it on the loan, and then whatever the payments don't cover, it picks up that interest and drops it in a separate bucket. And that separate bucket of accrued interest stays stagnant. It doesn't get charged the interest again. So then what happens is the 7% the following year goes back on to the $450,000 again, minus payments. And then that gets picked up and put in that separate bucket and gets and stays stagnant. So the bucket doesn't grow, but the principal is where the interest is charged on. But in the first couple of years, 7% is 7%. So let me see, what's 7% of 450,000?
It's a lot, 30,000 or something like that.
Yeah. So in the first year, whether it's simple or compound interest, there's going to be $30,000 of interest charged on the loan. The difference with simple interest is that even in year 20, it's going to be $30,000 of interest charged on the loan. But in the case where, you know, it's a, in fact, I can do this real quick. In the case where it's compound interest, the final year interest, instead of being that, it's actually going to be like $113,000 of interest in 1 year with compound interest, as opposed to the 30,000, it'll be like four times that amount. But in the first year, it's identical.
Yeah. So think about, I don't want to turn people off, but think about your Algebra 2 class. Think about your TI 84. You remember that? I don't know. Is that past your time, Rob, or did you use TI 84s too?
I had 82.
82. Okay. So I had an 80, I had an 84. You know, some of you advanced people out there might have had the 89 titanium version. Long story, basically, you know, my calculator was my best friend in high school, right? I'm just showing off my weirdness. So think about how you could model y equals x, where it's just a straight up line, versus y equals x squared. And so that's the difference between simple and compound. And if you remember, like, look at the very early part of that graph, those lines like are pretty much blended in together. You really can't tell very much of a difference between the two lines because it just looks so similar. But then long term, there's this massive difference where it's extremely different. And so what kind of happens with the way student loan interest works is it's the same exact interest every single year, but your overall balance grows kind of like on this additive level. And so, for example, like the $450,000 of student loans, like just pretending the person's paying back on like pay as you earn or something, you know, with like 100-ish K income. So early on, you have that 7% interest that you're getting hit with mostly all of it. But later on down the road, because that interest amount is just kind of growing additively, your total balance in 20 years is 800 something thousand. But the interest that's accumulating is only about 15,000 at that point, partly because your required payments are covering some of it. So if you look at the actual interest growth after your payments, it's like 15,000 of 800K is like 2%. And if you even look at the full 30,000 of interest based off of that 800K, what is that? That's like 3% or something like that. The effective interest rate on pay as you earn actually gets better and better and better over time. Like it gets less and less bad, which is really quite extraordinary, you know, because what if you have some inflation? Well, I mean, then student loans in the past 10 years could be like super free money. Any inflation at all would cause student loans to look like a great deal. And then with revised pay as you earn, the interest is actually even better than that, you know, because you have interest subsidies if the balance is super high relative to your income. So for example, with revised pay as you earn, the effective interest rate at the very end of your repayment, it's literally about 1%, just because, again, that interest is so subsidized and it's simple rate of interest. So that subsidy really doesn't show up for a long time. What makes student loan interest compound interest? So in the early part of your repayment, when that person leaves school, right, and they have 350,000 of principal and 100,000 of interest, when you leave school, that 100K capitalizes because you can't avoid it. Because whenever you exit your grace period, the loan interest capitalizes. And so you have that one compounding event. And what a lot of people do early on in their careers, right, Rob, they use a lot of forbearance, right? How often have you seen borrowers use forbearance in the first 5 years after graduation?
Much too often.
All the time, right? And so when you do that, every time you do forbearance, it compounds your interest. And so then what do people do? Well, we just extrapolate and just assume things are going to be the worst ever, right? That's what humans do mentally, is we just extrapolate what's currently going on and assume like this is the exact way it's going to be and this is the crisis that's going to happen. So like, for example, coronavirus. So I hope I'm correct in this. I really do hope I'm correct in this. But I think probably in 6 months, we won't be talking about coronavirus at all. And so the reason being is like everybody just extrapolates what's going on right now and says the world is going to fall apart because we had an additional number of cases and it's growing exponential. And so I'm going to map out this exponential growth just for forever because that's what I see right in front of my face. So I'm just going to assume that that's going to happen forever. And like, that's not the case, right? Before coronavirus broke out, everybody is probably thinking about whatever, like some major threat to America, whatever the most recent crisis was, that's the crisis that's going to ruin us. And I'm not saying that they're not things to worry about, but it's just, we have all these behavioral biases as humans where we don't look at things at all rationally. We look at them just kind of what's the most recent thing that occurred to us. And so when people think about how bad their interest is growing, well, it's because we know that it grows really bad in the very beginning, but then it gets really not bad at all later on. Now, there is one big exception to this. If you were paying so much that you're basically covering all of your interest because your income-driven repayment is high enough to basically cover all the interest, then that's the case where somebody would go ahead and refinance because what you're doing in that case is just having, you know, paying back your loan at a 6 or 7% interest rate and incurring extra interest expense. You're not getting any subsidies because your income is too high. Those are the people that need to refinance is, you know, your required payment is so high that your balance is falling, not increasing, because your required payment on your loans is so high and you're not going to qualify for PSLF or anything. You know, that's a case where the subsidies actually are not that relevant because you're making too much money relative to your balance. So I think that that's kind of an interesting point.
Yeah.
I don't know, thoughts about that?
Yeah, no, I did a projection of, let's just say it's a veterinarian who owes $300,000 and is making $100,000 and their salary is going to grow each year. So if their loan were to grow compounded and they're making like $700 a month payments a year on pay as you earn, if their loan were to grow like at 7% compounded, despite making those payments, at the end of the 20 years, their loan would have grown to like $741,000, all the while making like $200,000 of payments over the years. So that's huge. Now with simple interest, where with accrued interest, the loan balance grows, but only to $500,000. So it actually, compound interest versus simple interest over 20 years would save this person about a third, their loan balance would be a third lower just by having it be simple interest. And but in the first few years, you know, like 5 years, 4 years in, the difference in loan balance is only like $5,000. Compound interest would grow to 355 and the other one would grow to 350.
It's super close, right? Like it's super close together.
Yeah. And then if you take the net interest of their payments in year one, it's the same. But in the 20th year of making payments on pay as you earn, if it was compound interest, they'd actually, their loan would have accrued $35,000 of interest after payments. But with simple interest, it's only $6,000 of interest after payments. So that's like literally a $30,000 difference because the interest is advantageous to student loan borrowers compared to like a compound interest situation.
You have to fight your biases, right? Your biases, I don't know how you say that plural form, but your biases are your enemy when it comes to personal finance because it causes you to do things that are not rational.
Mm-hmm.
And we all have our biases. I'm not saying that they're not things that you need to pay attention to, but we have them. And you got to try to avoid them or else you're going to make a lot of mistakes. Clearest example ever, right? Everybody is thinking, okay, my interest is so bad. It's always going to be bad. I'm going to be destroyed. My balance is going to be 10 times what I owe today.
Mm-hmm.
And you haven't even run the numbers. You haven't run them. Like math is the best disinfectant. When I responded to that school recruitment person, I just literally explained the math. I was like, hey, like I get that you feel this way because you have pride in your school. But here's the math. You're going to borrow this amount. You're going to have this much. You're going to have this much loan fees, this much accrued interest, blah, blah, blah. You're quoting all these things that literally don't make sense when you look at the math.
Yeah. And to be fair, though, too, I mean, you used to be a bond trader and we both have our CFA. So we were well versed in debt and stuff like that. There's no other debt that I can think of out there that is nearly as complex and so different than any other sort of like debt rules of engagement. Like student loans are just a whole different ball of wax.
Yeah.
If we treat it, we just have to go, everyone should go with the assumption that student debt, you know, it is a little bit of an epidemic, but the rules that apply are actually better than trying to pay back credit card debt or mortgage debt or car debt. And you really need someone who knows the nuances of it to understand how this works because it is so, so different than anything else.
Well, like if I'm putting my investor hat on for a moment,
mm-hmm.
You know, the reason why people like buying the refinance student loans products, like as an investor, is because the treasury bond yields 1.5. So lending, you know, with an extra 2% yield to a doctor who's almost certainly going to pay it back at 3.5 kind of makes sense.
For sure.
And the doctor's happy because instead of paying 7 to the government, they're paying 3.5. That makes sense from an investor standpoint. But for somebody who owes a large balance relative to their what they earn in income, dude, I'd have to pay like pennies on the dollar for that kind of debt. Like, that is awful debt to own from an investor's perspective. Remember that earlier topic of the CBO, like saying the subsidy is somewhere between $11 billion, or maybe it's $260 billion, or maybe it's our number, which is $400 billion, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's because it's so attractive to pay back your loans on an income-based program long-term if you have a low income relative to what you owe, just because of this interest subsidy that people don't understand. And so maybe that's our job, Rob, is most people are not pharmacists or physicians or lawyers, but those professions, when they have special expertise, have to kind of like explain it in a simplified way for mass consumption. Because like, your typical person doesn't need to know what a tort is or what a specific surgical name is. But if you can explain it for when people need to know about it, that's what's helpful. So that's why I really wanted to focus on this for today's episode, is just to really hammer home this idea that your student loan interest is not nearly as bad as you think it is. And that's because of this behavioral bias where you myopically focus on what's happened the past couple of years, and that you just project that forward for the entire future of your loan repayment. And that's not it at all.
Yeah, absolutely.
I guess the action steps for this are, if you're freaked out about your student loan interest, don't be. If you haven't downloaded our calculator already, go to our site and just try to download that calculator, because it shows you how this interest works. If you go to one of the tabs of the calculator, it's probably one of the most emailed questions I get, is people who send me an email. They're like, hey, I saw an error in your calculator. It's wrong. Your balance is going to be like triple what you modeled.
I used the one on the student aid website, and it came up with something different.
Yeah, exactly. It's because you literally need to account for this accrued interest difference, because it's the biggest thing ever. Finance people, when I'm like on calls and I explain this to them, the light bulb goes off and they're like, oh my gosh, this is the biggest thing ever. And it's so funny, because like, people that are not in finance, they hear that and they're like, oh, like, cool, true, like accrued interest, great.
Yeah.
And it's like, no, like, this is such a big deal.
I remember, for me, I mean, when I joined up with you in the winter of 2017, like a little bit over 2 years ago, I mean, this blew my mind. I had absolutely no idea that it was how it worked. I had like 15 years of experience in the financial industry, and I had my CFA and CFP, and I still was like, this is incredible. It's like unbelievable.
Yeah. Rob is a pretty level-headed guy. He doesn't get thrown off by much. So that tells you how amazing this concept is, that he's even flabbergasted, right?
Flabbergasted, good word.
So what are the action steps? Okay, so if you have a student loan payment on federal loans that is fully covering all of your interest, you should have refinanced a while ago, right? So, you know, if you're not doing PSLF, let's keep that kind of front and center. Like, you're not doing PSLF, your payment is really covering most all of your interest. Well, go ahead and refinance it. So studentloanplanner.com/refi, apply a lot of those different companies. Also, people need to know that there's a whole bunch of people out there that if you have a private loan already, because you've already refinanced, you know, if you have refinanced any length of time, like longer than 3 months ago, you need to refinance again, because the rates are so, so low, Rob. They've really fallen off of a cliff because of weird combination of coronavirus and credit risk being super low at the same time. It's very strange, honestly, but basically what you need to know is rates are super, super low.
I just saw the 30-year treasury yesterday was at like 1.8%.
It's kind of nuts.
It's totally nuts.
Yeah, let's lock up our money for below inflation for 30 years. Sounds like nothing bad's going to happen, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you have debt that you're paying back, like, take advantage of it, because it might never happen again. You know, say the coronavirus gets cured, interest rates go up 1%, you're not going to be able to get anywhere close to as good of a deal on your student loan refinancing. So get moving on that if you need to. And then, you know, for people who are stressed out about their student loan interest, if you can't model this and explain like why it's okay and why it's not a problem to your, you know, family, spouse that's really worried about your debt, that's when you need a student loan plan, right? So studentloanplanner.com/help. Just check that out. Get a plan. Understand what your interest is and what the specifics are for your situation. But just don't freak out about it. There's 1,001 things worse than student loan interest. As painful as it seems, it's just because the pain always happens early on. And we're humans, and we extrapolate what happened yesterday for the next 20 years. And that's just the bias we all have to fight against.
Right. I found too that clarity, like understanding exactly how things are going to go in the future and like the projections beyond any type of cost savings that come from a consult, just the clarity of knowing what things look like and how things are actually going to be is just a huge relief for people, because now they know what they need to do. You know, instead of uncertainty and making things more drastic than they probably will be, the clarity plus the savings is like a really, really good reason to download that calculator. And if you need more help, then obviously schedule a consult with us.
Absolutely. So thanks so much, folks. And the best thing that you could do for us is just tell people about the show, Student Loan Planner Podcast. There's a whole bunch of people out there that can't afford our services that we want to help. And the best way I can think of to do that is by telling them about our blog, but especially this podcast. So Student Loan Planner Podcast, available everywhere, Spotify, iTunes. Suggest it to your friends. Hit the subscribe button. And hopefully we can keep entertaining you and making something as boring as student loan interest slightly exciting. Does that sound good, Rob?
Yeah, sounds good. Yeah, thanks, everybody.